Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. We'll start today with another story in the Imagine 2200, Climate Fiction for Future Ancestors, which was a climate fiction contest produced by Grist Magazine. This one is entitled The Isle of Beautiful Waters. A background in the illustration shows the sky with lines across it to indicate heavy rain. They are white lines that are on a diagonal against a green background. There are also the silhouettes of palm trees that are blowing very strongly, you can tell. Over all of this background is a rectangle that has a picture of five people. They are in a room that is lit by candles. They are different ages. One is an older person, two that are look like they're adults, and then two that look like children or a teenager and a child. They have dark curly hair, and the expressions on their faces are very serious. This story was written by Lily Sehor, first published January 17th, 2025. Number 1. Nady. It's 6 a.m. and the heat is rising quicker than the sun. Today is going to be another hot, smoldering day, as it has been for the past 6 months. The only difference, the humidity. If I must be honest, I liked it better when the air was dry. We are blessed to be one of the families living with the new architecture. For centuries, Creole houses have been designed to have trade winds flow through them from east to west. With the rising heat and longer droughts, many families have migrated to constructions with rounder walls, like our West African siblings, made to avoid angles and the accumulation of heat. Still, with the change of the season, the level of moisture in the air is suffocating. Even inside our home, the ambient wetness hugs the skin and refuses to let go. I wish I were 3 years old, running around in my underwear all day. Back then, Mama would place soursop leaves and guinea mint in a tin bucket all day in the sun. In the evening, she would bathe me with the water. I would feel refreshed and sleep so soundly. At 17, that attire is no longer an option, and a daily herbal bath would require way more water than we should spend. At least this present discomfort is a sign that the rains are coming. Mama is already clanking on pots, filling up a bowl with yam, cassava, and stewed meat. There is a flask of rum in her basket, some fruits, and of course, gourds filled with fresh filtered water. By the large calabash and sweet scent hanging in the air, I know that she has made use of the freshest hours before sunrise to fire up the griddle and prepare coconut cassav. Those sweet, goodness-filled pancakes made of cassava flour our Kalina ancestors have passed down to us. I give Mama a kiss. And like every morning, I pour water from our charcoal fountain into the mocha pot. Just enough. I pack the ground coffee in, and I heat up the stove to distill Ma Ni's morning brew. We are all going to the plateau today. It is time to lead our cattle to another spot where, we hope, they will be able to graze on something that is not dry for a couple of days and have sufficient shade to escape the sharp bite of the sun. Mama thinks it would do Ma Ni some good to visit the family's plot. As a child, Nini, as they called her, would visit this place in the deep countryside of St. Anne's. She would run and play with her siblings in the savanna, at the foot of the mango and the guineap trees, under the watchful eyes of her own grandmother, who had been born right there and had played there as a girl herself. My grandmother has so many stories about this place from the time before the yearly droughts, stories from her childhood, from the generations before her, but also legends of our island. Who knows, going there might spark memories and keep her with us a bit longer. I pop a few slices of breadfruit cake in the oven and call Ma Ni to the kitchen. Mama is glad her mother still answers to her name and walks without a stick. But I can tell she keeps a tight leash on her hopes. "Precious little girl," she says with a gentle smile, "why you shout me name like this? We if I go home." "Nady calling you for breakfast, Ma," Mama replies. "Nady? She me daughter Mercy," Me know me own pickney, Ma Nee says with a side eye. Aye, mercy, Ma. This me daughter, Nady. Mama does not skip a beat and leaves no room for further questions. Come get your breakfast now, Ma. Nady done make that good coffee you like from Grand Fawn, and the breadfruit cake is warming up. Yes, joy spreads all over Ma Nee's face. You remembered get the coffee from the place. Mama joins Ma Nee, and they finish the sentence together. Where they did not grow bananas. Ma Nee laughs, and it turns on a light in Mama's eyes. The truth is, our island stopped the production of coffee in those areas decades before I was born. The French authorities had allowed the spraying of chlordecone on banana crops, but never fully dealt with the leftover residue. Even though they claimed it was safe to grow fruit trees on top of polluted soil, the industry suffered from the bad publicity, and only a few independent producers on our wing of the butterfly-shaped island still persist. It's almost 7 a.m. Papa is in the driver's seat, and Ma Nee is sitting next to him. Mama and I have hopped in the back of our family's old pickup. Each of us has grabbed our large bakwa before leaving. When we get there, the sun will already be fully at work, and we will need the extra protection. These hats were once reserved for fishermen, no larger than shoulder width and with a cone shape like top to dissipate the heat. They are now a necessity during the hotter months and are made quite large to protect the head and provide shade to the upper body. I love the short trip to Fonds-les-Mains. Once we leave the public road, we plunge onto a tough road that pretends to be neat for a while but quickly turns bumpy and is only an introduction to the next one, a dirt one that is made of hills and valleys. Mama holds on to her hat and her basket. I too hold on to my bakwa and keep a hand on the railing. We pass the spot where Ma Nee's grandmother was born. The house is no longer standing, but we always acknowledge it and lower our heads in a respectful nod. We drive on and pass through a majestic green arch formed by two giant mango trees that sit on both sides of the dirt road. It is said that Ma Nee's grandfather, Papa Charles, once left his garden in Fonds-les-Mains after sunset, a great taboo, but these trees are home to duppies that are known for being playful. The spirits started humming at him, louder and louder, but he knew you are not supposed to acknowledge them or things may get worse. Papa Charles put a little speed in his steps and did not look back. We park near the small pond where Mama's people have been fetching water for their animals since no one here can remember. Over the years, they have made it deeper and shaded it with trees to slow down evaporation. We all go to the one kapok tree, a majestic tree that itself is a piece of history. Mama digs a small hole between its huge roots. She hands the flask of rum to Ma Nee, who takes a swig and pours the rest in the hole. Papa places a square of banana leaf at the bottom of the hole. Then Mama pours the yam, cassava, and stewed meat she had packed earlier. She fills the hole back in and hands me a small gourd of water. I take a swig and pour the rest on our gift to the ancestors. The soil is cracked, and our cows look battered. Papa fixes his bakwa and goes to tend to them. Mama and I find shade under a very old and large guinup tree and sit with Ma Nee, who brushes the dry earth from the heel of her foot, eyes brimming with stories. She and Mama press their backs on the trunk, and I sit facing Ma Nee. Number 2. Ma Nee. Me done fell here from this tree once, I tell my daughter and the nice woman who looks like her. Me done come here every Saturday with me mommy and me sisters. Me brother older than we, so he don't want to come. He stay home doing big boy business, but I here on we family land with Toto, Sai, mommy, and me grandmother, Mano. I see the curiosity in their faces. They want to hear the story of how I fell. But I am tired, and the heat is oppressive. Guadalupe has always been hot. We are in the Caribbean, after all, but I do remember days when people just left a metal barrel by their gardens, and it was enough water to sustain production for an entire family. 6 months without rain was a phenomenon that was never heard of. As a child, I used to enjoy the dry season. I did not truly know what the cracks in the soil meant, but I enjoyed leaping over them. They made me feel like the world was about to open beneath my feet and I would be able to explore the depths of the earth. Now these cracks have become rifts, and indeed you could dive deep into their darkness. They have become traps where cattle and uncareful children can lose a leg. And to think that we were once called the Isle of Beautiful Waters. In a way, we have taken a path that has led us away from this name. In a way only, the waters are still beautiful. The issue is that some of them are polluted. France did we dirty with that color de cone. Yes, Ma, the woman says. She has a sadness to her. Perhaps I can change that. Me done tell you already how we island came to be. My daughter looks not quite like my daughter, but I recognize these eyes. They are round and have an appetite for the world. The goddess Atabi was bathing in the Caribbean Sea. Beautiful she was with her golden bracelets, her queenly earrings, and her wonderfully carved golden half-moon hanging between her breasts. Her husband, Sukemo, had offered her a necklace made of precious pearls and a butterfly she did wear with pride. One day she done learn of his indiscretions. You see, Sukemo was known for having a soft spot in his heart for beautiful women. Atabe was so smitten by grief and anger, she did snatch the necklace from her own neck and threw the pearls across the Caribbean Sea. Then became the islands, and the butterfly became Guadalupe. And why is it called? I do not recognize this child. Is Marise old enough to have a daughter this age? Precious little girl, do you know Marise? 3. Marise. And why is it called the Isle of Beautiful Waters? Nady asks. My mother looks confused. Precious little girl, do you know Marise? Ma asks. Yes, Ma. She turns to look at me. She's my daughter. She beautiful. She looked like you when you was her age. I no look beautiful now, Mommy, I laugh. Yes, baby, she takes my hand in her wrinkled ones and for a moment stares at me with a smile until I can tell that this reality has dissolved and she has moved to a different one. She lets go of my hand. Nady, darling, perhaps you can refresh my niece's memory, I say to my daughter. Then I pretend I am listening to this story I have heard countless times and hope none of them can guess that inside I am screaming. I want to hold on to my mother, but I truly do not know how long I will be able to keep her at home. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Number 4. Nady. Legend tells us of an Arawak princess who lived on the island Watukubuli, Dominica, today. Her true name has been lost to the millennia, but she called herself Anuk. She was forbidden to bathe alone in the waters. At the time, the gods roamed the earth, and the blue serpent god, Iniki, younger brother to Quetzalcoatl, had taken the habit of leaving Abyalyala, the continent, which was too crowded by other gods. So he went to the islands and bathed in their waters. He loved Watukubuli above all. Anuk's father did not want her to fall prey to the blue serpent god. He was known to devour young, beautiful flesh, but the princess had a mind of her own, and in her father's short absence, she went to the river and bathed alone in a plunge basin. Alas, within minutes, the water started gurgling, and a giant blue snake slithered up from the depths. He was magnificent, scales blue as the sea, eyes and underbelly yellow. He had feathers on the back of his head, the colors of the rainbow. The princess was not afraid. She let the snake coil around her legs and around her belly. Together they danced in the water for hours. When she came back to her village that same night, her belly was round and full. This made her father angry, and he banished her to the Butterfly Island, which was dry like the desert. Anuk was sad and alone, but not for long. Instead of a child, she laid a multitude of eggs. When they hatched, they became the fierce Kalina people. Their father, the blue serpent god Iniki, called upon the waters and created cascades, rivers, and ponds of all sizes. The land became lush, and the Kalina people lived in abundance on the Butterfly Island they now called Kaluachara, the Isle of Beautiful Waters. Number 5. Marcy. My daughter has a hunger for the stories. She knows them all and is always eager to hear them once more. At her age, I was very different. My excitement was reserved for other things. I must say, it feels good to see her take after my own mother and keep the tradition. All our phones ding at the same time. That is the sound of an official alert. I look, and indeed, there is news. Nady, go tell your father we must change our plans. The hurricane that was coming to Antigua is headed further south, straight for us. We were only expecting bad weather, but it will be a storm. We are used to them now, but we have work to do. I turn to my mother. Ma, now I understand why the weather is so humid and hot today. A hurricane coming, a big one. Ah, it go be like Hugo in 1989? Ma, you know they change. You was little Pickney in 1989. It was serious business, she emphasizes. Oh, I know, Ma. Me seen the archives. Today they all worse. Only the smallest ones is like Hugo. Ah, my mother opens her mouth in astonishment. But don't worry, Ma. It's early. We still have some time to snack on the cassab, and we can head home to prepare. Number 6. Nady. It is 5:30 p.m., and night is already claiming the rays of the sun. Mama, Papa, and I have joined the neighbors to bar windows and put tape on any exposed glass. Those who live in more fragile housing secure space for themselves and their families with other members of the community. Our communal water cisterns have been protected from harsh wind and any debris that may contaminate them. Mama and I have made sure our dry food reserves are where we need them to be. Now my favorite part begins. We prepare the candles and some snacks so we can tell each other stories during the worst of the storm to keep everyone calm. Mani, will you tell me again the story of the Africans coming to Guadalupe? I step into my grandmother's room, and she is not there. Mama, is Mani with the neighbors? No, she is home. What do you mean? Number 7. Mani. I dislike being outside when the sun is already setting, but I know it's not proper of me to abuse these people's kindness. I have to go home. There should be a June plum tree here, and this road should be dirt, not asphalt. I might be lost. With some luck, Papa Charles will be coming from his garden soon. He'll help me. Let me have a seat. It's too dark now. Where is Papa Charles? Papa Charles? If I call him out loud, maybe he will come. I think he cannot see me in the pitch black. Papa Charles, me want go home. Tell Mommy we want my go home. I start to cry. Duppies forget me on de road. Me scared. 8. Marcy. We have looked in the kitchen garden. We have scoured the backyards of our closest neighbors, and there is no sign of my mother. Darkness is fully here, and with the storm coming, they are going to cut electricity everywhere. We need to find her. I must not let Nady see my distress, but I am terrified of what could happen. Nady, baby, I steady my voice as much as I can. Give me a torchlight. I go see Aunt Toto's old house. You go with your papa and see around the baker's. She always looking for sweet things. Why did I refuse to put a tracker on her? Hurricanes make landfall at night. We only have about 90 minutes before the first winds. Number 9. Mani. Me sorry, Mommy, me sorry. You're okay, Mani, you're okay. Papa Charles angry with me. Nobody's angry, Mani, you're good. We go home now. Yes, Mani, I'm taking you home, your daughter waiting for you. Number 10, Nady. It's 8 p.m. Mani was out for at least 2 hours, and most of it in the darkness. Both she and Mama look quite shaken. Papa does his best to lighten the mood with jokes and rubbed shoulders, but the anxiety that just visited us is only turning away to leave space for the hurricane, which is no comfort. Nady, baby, tell us a story, Mama asks. There was a time when Kalina gods would spend their leisure time observing and visiting Kalutsera. It was such a quiet island with beautiful waters and a powerful but peaceful people. One day boats were spotted from afar. They were large constructions of wood that somehow did not sink into the sea. They seemed to be pushed by clouds of cloth and slid as oil toward the island. The Kalina people did not fully understand what was happening. but were hospitable. They were horrified when the spirits of the sea coming off the boats, the Palanakili, returned their welcome with attacks on their families. The Kalina chased them all away, but they had underestimated the Palanakili's greed. They came back with more boats, more weapons, and something special in the bellies of their ships. The war being waged on the beach was paralleled by another one in the heavens. The Kalina god Hurakan gathered his winds and attacked the fleets that had not yet landed. When he was about to unleash the worst of his fury, he was interrupted by Yamoya, goddess of the sea and mother to those made cargo. She pleaded with Hurakan for the lives of her children, but in order to save them, she had to save the Palanakila as well. This is how the ugliest of trades started on our beautiful island and in the Americas. For centuries after that, it is said that Yomaha and Hurakan conspired and finally managed to get rid of the evil. The legends say that it required them to sacrifice a lot of their powers. That is why they have trusted us with the responsibility to make sure that this scourge never comes back. The winds outside are rising, and I look up in the candlelight to see Mani falling asleep. This story is part of Imagine 2200, Climate Fiction for Future Ancestors, a climate fiction contest produced by Grist Magazine. Imagine 2200 asked writers to imagine the next 180 years of equitable climate progress, and the winning stories feature intersectional worlds in which no community is left behind. You can read all 12 stories in the collection. Special thanks to this year's judges, Annalie Newitz and Omar El Akkad. About the author, Lily Sayor is a writer from Guadalupe, a butterfly-shaped island in the Caribbean. She is a Black woman of trans experience, currently residing in Paris at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities. So much free paint for her canvas. Her writing can be found in Afrotrans, an anthology, 2021, and various places online. In a column called Sustainable Food and Farming, an article, A Crop for a Saltier Future? This is by Ashley Simpson, first published January 10th, 2025. The picture that illustrates it shows a dark blue sky in the background, and then there are rows of dirt like we would see on a farm. But instead of the usual kinds of plants that we see growing out in fields, these plants look like underwater ocean plants. With sea levels rising and groundwater running out, crops that thrive in salt water could bolster future food supplies. In early 2020, a group of Saudi farmers led Vanessa Molino into the desert. Molino, a plant physiologist, was looking for hardy crops that could thrive in harsh, arid conditions. After driving for hours, the group arrived at salt lakes in the desert, like glistening white pans you can see from a distance. Spindly green shoots of wild salicornia emerged from the water, flourishing despite salt literally build up in crystals on the surface of the soil, she said. These plants are remarkable. Salicornia, also known as samphire, sea beans, sea asparagus, glass wort, and pickleweed, is a halophyte, a group of salt-loving species that blossom in conditions that would be fatal to other plants. Recently, scientific interest in salicornia has spiked thanks to concern over increasing soil salinity, the result of rising seas, prolonged drought, and human activities like deforestation and seawater irrigation. Saudi Arabia is hardly alone in its salty dilemma. By some estimates, more than half of the globe's arable land could become too salty to farm by the year 2050. A recent study from NASA predicts that salt water will taint 77% of the coastal aquifers, groundwater systems that deliver fresh water inland, by 2100. These conditions will be a death sentence for many conventional crops, which aren't bred to handle high levels of salinity. What will farmers grow in the salty fields of the future? Molino thinks it might be salicornia. Cultures around the world have utilized salicornia for centuries to produce glass and soap, while countries from France to Turkey to Korea have long regarded the plant as a culinary delicacy. Salicornia proliferates in coastal deltas, mangrove swamps, and salt marshes, growing in small, short bushes. Recognizable by its bright green and knobbly stalks, which boast a satisfying crunch ideal for stir fries, salads, or even pickles, salicornia is high in fiber. Its seeds can be used to produce an oil that's rich in protein and fatty acids. That's why Molino, now a lecturer at the University of Newcastle in Australia, is working to transform the plant, which grows wild around the world, into a domesticated crop. While it took our ancestors thousands of years to domesticate wheat and corn, we don't have that kind of time, said Molino. To speed up the process, she and her international research team have gathered the hardiest specimens they could find from all over the world and are now breeding them in nurseries in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Domesticating salicornia would be a huge step forward in getting the plant into the hands of farmers who are struggling to adapt to rising seas and salty soils, said Yannick Nyberg, founder and CEO of Seawater Solutions, a Scottish organization that restores degraded coastland around the world and helps communities adopt a climate-friendly farming practice. In Vietnam's Mekong Delta, where 18 million people depend on rice production for their livelihoods, and saltwater intrusion is predicted to soon cause up to $3 billion in crop losses a year, Seawater Solutions is teaching farmers to grow salicornia and develop a market for the crop. Nabi Nut, a farm outside Ho Chi Minh City, for instance, once grew lemongrass, watermelon, and squash using pumped groundwater, a method that can hasten saltwater intrusion. Today, its owners are running trials growing salicornia, irrigating the plants with brackish water from nearby canals, and selling it to high-end restaurants in the city, where chefs incorporate it into dishes like salicornia marinated gazpacho and salicornia pakora. Well, our time is out for now, but we haven't finished this interesting article about a plant that might be on our tables in the future. We'll stop there for today. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. I'm Deborah McFadder, your volunteer reader from Flagstaff. Thanks a lot for listening.